Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Yes, we are burning down the house. Happy New Year. I'm Curtis B. Wayne here on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. It's a new year, 8th of January, 2012. We made it through a truly trying 2011. Now it's 2012. It's a great year, going to be a great year. It's going to be the end of the Mayan calendar. There are lots of things to look forward to as we move forward in discussions about design, architecture, and the creative arts. In this episode, I want to talk about the oft times blurring lines between architectural design, urban design, landscape, and things that populate the landscape. To that end, I've asked two principals of an organization called Terraform One. Mitchell Joachim, did I pronounce that correctly? Yes,
yeah,
and
absolutely.
Melanie Fessel. Mitchell has a CV that runs to 18 pages or something.
That's a short one.
He has a PhD in the philosophy of architecture.
Computation.
Oh, God. All right. Well, we can talk about that. And MAUD, that's a Master of Architecture and Urban Design from my alma mater, Harvard Graduate School of Design, an MArch from Columbia, and a Bachelor of Architecture Professional Studies from SUNY Buffalo. But before we get down to it, let's have a little moment of respectful contemplation.
Gonna do the drop.
Burning Down the House, this Sunday, 8th of January, is brought to you by White Oak Pastures. White Oak Pastures cattle are raised in a manner that is and has stood the test of time. It begins with southern sunshine, unpolluted country air, and a fertile coastal soil. The cattle are allowed to roam the pastures and graze freely on sweet native grasses all of their lives. White Oak Pastures, all natural grass-fed beef has been available in all of the Whole Foods stores in the Mid-Atlantic states, and we hope that you will support their program through your purchase of our beef through one of these Whole Foods stores. For more information, go to www.whiteoakpastures.com. Available at Whole Foods stores in the Mid-Atlantic states. Those of you who are listening from Helsinki, you'll have to go to whiteoakpastures.com and order it up by international delivery. Probably DHL come in a little casket with... How do they ship beef these days? carbon dioxide. Right. So, we have two designers of international repute. You guys have won all kinds of awards all over the place, and your practice, or your interlapping practice, every time I went to a different website, there was a different organization. You're manifesting organizations all over the place. The both of you have... we're with Melanie Fessel and Mitch Joachim, who are both involved in Terraform One. Also, Melanie has her own organization, Odyssey One, and then there's Terrafuge, apparently. There's all these different overlapping think tanky things, and... Tell us what you're up to.
First of all, thanks very much for inviting us on the show.
I'm very happy to have you here.
We're super glad to be here. And love anything that's happening in Brooklyn. Used to live in this neighborhood.
That's great.
Really great. My mom was born in Fort Greene.
That's super.
So Brooklyn is the future, now and always will be. We have a number of organizations that revolve around Terraform One. Planetary One, Terrafuge, One Odyssey, One Prize, and the One Lab. All of them do different things and perform different functions, from teaching things about urban farming to computation or parametrics to just learning about the city itself and working to change the community.
We know a lot about urban farming here at Heritage Radio Network. We're sitting... those of you who are new listeners won't know this, but those of you who are old-time listeners know that our studio is under an urban greenhouse. We're in two shipping containers, and just above us is a year-round urban farm, a little tiny urban farm. And just next door across the Roberta's Farm lot, there are more rooftop farms, and also the people here are hosts at Roberta's Restaurant. We're part of the founding group of the urban farm experiment known as Brooklyn Grange. I'm sure you know a lot of those people.
Mm-hmm.
And those people are our people. So welcome.
Good people.
You're all part of the tribe here. So now, Melanie, what's your involvement? Or how did you become involved in this gang of free-thinking people?
Well, it was just pure interest, I guess.
Sent them a postcard and said, hey, I'm interested in what you're doing?
Exactly. And then I got on board. And since almost 5 years, we are working together. And it has been a very great process. And as you mentioned before, there are lots of different parts being involved in Terraform One. It has to do with the school we're hosting every year in the summer. It has to do... we also have a bio lab where we do molecular cell biology to create architecture. And there's all sorts of very funny things going on with lots of different people. And I think when Mitch mentioned before, we're in this crazy house on 33 Flatbush Avenue, the Max. And it's a hub of very interesting people from very different backgrounds. And I think that's what makes it very unique.
Yeah, the MEX stands for Metropolitan Exchange. It's a 7-story building. 45,000 square feet. That's kind of like a new version of a Bauhaus. A little bit sloppy, but it's filled with great people. There's about 40 different companies, from architects to chefs to farmers to molecular cell biologists to roboticists, all in one place. There's no structure, so it's very horizontal, and we share spaces. And trade ideas in this very transdisciplinary manner.
Do you live there?
No, we live in Brooklyn Heights.
Uh-huh. So it's a workspace. It's a multi-floor loft. It's a lofty aspiration to associate yourself, with the tradition of the Bauhaus Stiftung.
We like it because it's instantly recognizable. I think for a semiotic pulse, I think we can get there quicker if I say something like Bauhaus. It's a creative arts space where it's not really limited to one particular facet of art. It's got so many different disciplines crushed into one area that it almost forces relationships.
So, Mitch, do you envision yourself as the grope or the mies of the of the mex? I mean, you brought it up.
Yeah. Never ever thought about it.
Asking questions here. Aha. Uh-huh. Neither.
I can't answer. I like grope is just grope. Maybe we'll just, without the grope, yes, I'll take the grope part. I was thinking more curmudgeon. But uh-huh. it's a We don't believe in it necessarily, which is why we work so hard every day to make it into something. To actually achieve some level of fruition requires a lot of effort on all the folks there. And a lot of us have these kinds of personalities that need distilling through work. So we actually try and live up to the expectations that we have. And we never started off to even make something like this. The Metropolitan Exchange came from a group called Interborough. And these guys found a man by the name of Alatera, who looks like Moses or Santa Claus on the street. And this guy decided to donate more or less a seven-story building with a metal shop and a wood shop in the basement and a farm on the roof, which is all the things that we brought to it, and let us kind of think about what the future is of transdisciplinary and working environments.
So
collaborative spaces.
So was that one of your expectations or goals in starting to work collaboratively, that you what were your expectations?
So we didn't come in with a plan, which is unusual for architects. Sorry about that.
But it's hard to come in with a plan when you don't have a business plan.
Right.
If you're looking for funding, that is difficult.
Yeah, we're always looking for funding, but we're looking for like-minded folks around the same level. Mid-careerist, but very adventurous.
Uh-huh.
People that just decide to break out of the corporate boxes that we've all been kind of bred to work in, and all of us have survived those corporate boxes. And now we're hanging a shingle on a door and calling it our own design places, so that we can work in our own idiom and kind of achieve things that are that are outside the norm, whatever that might be.
We'll get back to outside the norm because
we're burning down the house. We love the talking heads.
I hope you're ready. I will engage you in some debate.
This house is made of wood, or the studio is made.
All steel.
Oh, I see. It's the interior.
Right. If we spontaneously combust in here, there'll be nothing but ashes. But the shipping container will be perfectly fine. I do want to talk about outside the norm.
Great.
And I will probably put you to task in the last segment on a level equivalent to your defense of your doctoral dissertation, but in a way that you probably have not expected, because you probably haven't listened to previous episodes of Burning in the House. But let's not get all serious here. No, I like the idea of collaborative and interdisciplinary exchanges. Let's talk about some of the projects that you have premiated. I like that word. That's a good word. That's one of those words. That's one of those architect-y, intellectual-ish words like premiation or intervention. There are a couple of different projects here that I've printed out that I wanted to talk about. One is the blimp as trolley.
Yeah.
And the other is a sort of octopus city form. And then eventually also I want to talk about this trash scraper project that both you, Melanie, and Mitch worked on. Well, let's just dive in. Tell us about these different projects, especially the blimp as trolley. That's got real traction.
Cool. We don't really limit ourselves as designing in one particular scale. I think that we actually think that design happens pretty much from the smallest to the largest. Our tagline is, we'll do everything from the doorknob to the democracy. I think that architects have always kind of had the capacity and the training and the comprehension to take on many different projects at any level, and we make that our kind of credo. So when it comes to issues of transportation, we don't think that we should be limited by just designing the city around vehicles. That was my dissertation at MIT with the Smart Cities Group, where we looked at designing a future car. Since then, when we started this company, thought about looking at different modes of transportation systems that fit the city and are specifically new and maybe born from products that are already in existence. So one big fantasy was the Thanksgiving Day Parade, which our daughter absolutely loves. There's these giant floating fat balloons of Homer Simpson or Bart Simpson and Spider-Man and SpongeBob. And it takes about 40 guys to hold them down, more or less. And this is rather exciting. There's a lot of wind issues, etc. And we thought, why not begin the idea of a transportation system that harnesses that energy and allows for floating balloons to serve as a slow-mo transit system that gently floats with these ski lift-like chairs hanging off the blimps that you jump on, jump off. It doesn't move very fast, goes about 13 miles an hour, more or less, and you have an attendant just in case to help you on the chairs, and you float or waft through the city. And there'd be some kind of a funicular, some system that would make sure they stay on track just in case. But that was the base concept for yet another form of mobility. We called it the Blimp Bumper Bus. And we presented it to a group at the MoMA. And this lady in the back stood up and she was, you know, cheering. I can't really show on the radio what it's like, but she was really happy. And she said from all the way in the back of the room that my wheelchair can fly. And she just was, to her, this was the most fabulous thing. We never thought of handicap accessibility or any ADA guidelines while producing it, but we did want to think about forms of mobility that privilege those who don't have the ability to move, or the very young or the very old, where we're all going to be one day or have been. And think about these kinds of ways of moving around the city. So the Blimp Bumper Bus is connected to not only just thinking about folks who have limited mobility, but all forms of transportation that we call soft. And this is the idea of soft cars, soft blimps, soft mobility is thinking that we got to stop moving around shiny metal boxes. We should think about a form of gentle congestion where it's okay to rub up against your neighbor.
You mean like walking?
Pedestrians are the kind of the alpha position to explore a city. The foot is the best interface.
Okay, so you never really intended this to be a practical suggestion.
All our work is kind of propaganda based, and for you know, can I say shits and giggles on the air? I don't know. But
no, we're not. We can say, we can drop F bombs. We can say whatever okay. We like, because we're not subject to FCC here.
If it turns us on where we get our jollies, if it's something that's kind of exciting, that's why we go for it. We produce a series of drawings and then we use them as argument pieces. So if it gets watered down or through some value engineering system into something wholly different, that would be unfortunate. But it starts with this with that impulse.
Well, value engineering suggests it was real in the first place.
Yeah.
And these are just sort of agitprop.
Well, I think that it's more of the mentality here is one of free and open thinking, and it is a kind of a polemic, if you would like.
Well, I understand that.
I also think generally that infrastructure is just not celebrated enough in the United States.
Not at all.
It's really about the, you know, the shiny metal box. And I'm from Europe, and I grew up on a bike, and you're very respectful, and you drive in cities, and, you know,
right.
You're kind of enjoying and celebrating, you know, like going around in cities. And here, it's just a nightmare. I mean, on the way here, we almost got killed by a car because, you know, like, they don't look out for pedestrians. And it's just, I mean, the notion would kind of be that we make infrastructure the new centers of our cities, which would be a totally different notion than what they are right now. So.
Well, sure. In Paris, you can go and take a tour of the sewers. Not
yeah,
New
Berlin
York.
Too. Yeah.
I know.
Well, yeah, I guess that idea, that's a very good point, Melanie, is that instead of celebrating skyscrapers as the center of our cities, or previously cathedrals, you know, the kind of religious centers being the kind of the meaning of a city, we want to kind of turn infrastructure into a spectacle. Infrastructure should be something that folks are proud of. That would be my or our version of the city beautiful movement, is the kind of the roadways, the arteries, the kind of the lungs, the things that provide us with the food, energy, water, mobility systems in our everyday lives.
And
to turn that into
too.
Blimps are certainly a part of it. Well, soft mobility is a larger meta theme.
You mentioned all of these things in one long stream here, and you mentioned roadways and parkways and all of that stuff that Lewis Mumford talked a lot about in the 20th century. I myself would rather excise, that is to say, remove conversations about cars altogether.
I'm all for it. We need the dialogue, and we need to open it up. Blimps is one way of doing it, but we don't want to locate it on blimps. We did these projects called the Hug and Kiss Lamb Car. It's kind of sheep-like cars that move in flocks and herds.
You have a whole series, and if you go to terraform.org, that's TerreForm.org, you can see a whole series of soft vehicles, which is an interesting idea. It's all riffing on the idea of bumper cars that we might possibly ride if you go down to Atlantic City or some other a coastal amusement park, which is interesting as a departure point for conversations about the utility of cars in the first place.
Yeah.
And certainly by ridiculing them.
Well, would you like to see cars just disappear from New York, at least in the downtown?
Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. The fascination with you can go anywhere at any time. Every man, woman, and child for themselves, I think, is played out. Unfortunately, we will have to wait probably 40 years until oil runs out. Yeah. But by then, there'll be electric cars, and there'll probably be twice the number of cars, although they may be half the size. What that means, I don't know. I don't know whether there might possibly be eventually some sort of integration between cars and elevators, or cars and escalators, or...
Yeah, in the journal,
or something weird like
that. Yeah, totally. In the journal Science, there was a kind of a recent article called "Stab the Electric Car in the Heart and Bury the Corpse," and it was this thought about: there's nothing wrong with electric cars, but it's the battery systems that we're going to have a lot of trouble with. There's over something like 50 rare earth metals that are required to produce the batteries, whatever type there are, and we'll just never have enough batteries compared to the amount of oil. In fact, you can measure the amount of metals in 1 milligram per capita globally of all the folks on the earth.
Well, we don't have enough neodymium even coming out of the mines in China to make all the permanent magnets that all these motors will need.
Exactly.
Right.
So the electric car, at least as far as the battery in certain parts, the motors are very simple. It's very difficult to get access to those particular metals. But we did a project called Homeway, which we made the world's largest SUV, or at least imagine the world's largest SUV for the suburbs. And we called these Sarah Palin SUVs, more or less giant houses on wheels.
Now, you're not going to get very much funding, Mitch, if you start running down political. You're not nearly as cute as Tina Fey.
Right.
that might not be wise. But what was the Sarah Palin what?
The idea of the Sarah Palin SUV is to have such big vehicles, in fact, your whole house on wheels or treads or walking legs, so that you use all of the oil up as quickly as possible so that we can achieve peak oil in 2 years and then switch the grid into something more reasonable, like renewable sourced by, or sourcing electric systems. So this is this thought that we can get over peak oil almost instantly.
But basically, it was also the thought that our cities would become linear and they would be connected with the interstate and the highway system, which is what made the United States of America. And right. So we kind of envisioned that, that people would assemble their houses to become mobile and would move onto those large arteries, which are already existing. And then on those arteries,
we already tried that.
You did?
Sure. We've got. Parks and parks of mobile homes,
yeah,
and fleets of RVs, and actually I blame you and your countrymen. You had for two reasons: one,
the Autobahn.
You invented the Autobahn, and two, you lost World War II, so that when General Eisenhower came back from Europe, he said, "Yes, we need German style Autobahns all over the United States. They were so marvelous and wonderful." It's okay. It's not your personal, failure, but it is
my country's failure.
Yeah, as well.
Yeah, but I mean, we should see something negative as something positive, and I think that was kind of the take on this whole project. Like, why wouldn't we kind of merge the two of them together, and it would be the perfect marriage?
Take it all the way to the max.
Yeah, it came from this idea that there are about 3 million Americans right now that live in RVs. Most of them are retirees and elderly folks that kind of dwell in the United States on wheels, and they move around.
Yeah,
and
that's just less than 1% of the population of the United States. So it's not really significant.
We wanted to ramp
it
up. We wanted to ramp it up and rebrand it. I think what the
make us all homeless. Thank you so much.
Or take nomadic, them home with you, basically.
Or rootless.
Nomadic.
Rootless, I guess, yeah. Nomadic.
Well, Florida is great, but eventually you get tired of guys in ball hugger bikini things, and you want to go to a place where there are libraries, like the Northeast. So you should have this kind of choice of
well, there are some people, and we've talked about that on this program, who would abolish the library as a totally arcane and useless sort of thing. It's interesting that you talk about, you know, the notion of basically walking cities, because I saw some parallels between your peristaltic city and Archigram.
Oh, yeah.
The walking city.
Yeah.
I didn't see any footnotes, but that's okay. Peter Cook is not offended.
It's like footnoting the Beatles if you're in the rock business today. I mean, it's just everything that's ever been done probably happened in the 60s and a bit in the 70s. I think that was the most exciting time in architecture, both in Europe and America. Ron Heron and the Walking City Project and Archigram in general. We admittingly are a kind of a third generation love slave of a lot of their concepts and are still pushing them and refining them. And there's nothing. I think they're absolutely fantastic.
All right,
I couldn't do better than Archigram.
Love no.
beams to the
no,
to those
no,
folks.
No, absolutely. And we can talk a little bit about the parallels between Terry Gilliam's Brazil and Peristaltic City.
Brazil is my favorite movie.
It's one of my favorites. There are a few things that I would like to talk about in the next segment. I'd like to talk about where you get funding. Uh-huh. I'd like to take a little bit of time to talk about what your research methodology is. Do you get into cognitive science at all? Dr. Wilfried Wang from Berlin was our guest just a few weeks ago, and he's very much involved with the Deutsche Forschungsgemeinschaft in their inquiries into applying cognitive science into making architecture that is more satisfying. So I'm going to give you a little time to think about talking about that, and we'll take a little break, some Peter Gabriel music. No, this is... Wait! Stop that, Jack. Wait. I got out of playlist. I'm sorry. Go to the next break. Thank you. I'm sorry.
Leave his mark, leave his mark.
burning down the house here on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Here with Mitch Joachim and Melanie Fessel from Terraform, Terrafugue, Terramath. I don't know. You have many Terraforms here.
Absolutely.
We're talking about the fusion between urban design, architecture, transportation, the shape of our cities, what to do with all of our trash, what to do with this fascination with driving everywhere, all of the things that are the bane of modern life as received notions. That's one of the wonderful things that I learned from Eisenman before he got too big for his britches, literally and figuratively. He talked about received notions and acculturated notions, both in design and also environment. And we might get back to that. I'm curious as to how it is that you get funding for all of these designs.
Well, do you want to say where you work part-time, and then you want to...
Yeah, so I mean, I have a part-time job with the Institute for Sustainable Design at Cooper Union.
Yeah, is that a new thing there?
Didn't
have that when I went.
Exactly. It's about time, I think. It's, it's obviously questions we have to raise, and it's very sad that it's not more integrated in the curriculum there at Cooper Union, but hopefully we can push the boundaries of, you know, of that notion. And yes, we do exhibitions, we have symposiums.
I'm all for it. You know, yeah. Also, Cooper's ready to have a dean who's actually an architect. It's all well and good to have Tony in there, but he ain't an architect.
He's a historian, yes. He's an amazing professor, I have to say. But
yeah. I'm glad to hear that. Yes. Every time he sees me coming, he turns away.
I had dinner with him the other night. He's Tony. There's some difficulties with the school right now.
And, no shit.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah.
I'd like to see that change. If NYU could help out, I think that'd be pretty fantastic.
No. We don't want NYU's help. Thank you very much. No.
That's right.
Cooper Union may be
you only use our
bankrupt,
libraries and
but, everything. No, there are ways of managing that. No,
it'd be better for NYU. I clearly think it's a one-way, NYU doesn't, Cooper would give us all the benefits, I think.
Well, we're all... caveat, we can digress as much as we like because it's my show and it's right. The format to digress. But the foundation of Cooper Union is that the library should be open to the public without exception at all times. That is part of the tradition of Cooper Union. And when I was there as a student, anybody could walk in and use their library. Now you have to go... It's like the Andromeda strain?
Yes, I do.
You have to go through all those levels of decontamination before they let you into the lab.
Yep, four levels. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, for me as an alum, it's difficult. So I gave up. It's just easier to do my work online or to call up somebody that I know who was a graduate of Columbia and go up to Avery.
Yeah,
which those of you who are out of the United States probably don't know that Avery Library at Columbia has the largest collection of architectural materials arguably in the world. Mm-hmm. You're a Columbia grad. Is it the world or just the United States?
I'm not sure if it's the world. It is the most exceptional, definitely more so than Harvard for its collection. So the Avery periodicals are the place to go to as the kind of source for any kind of magazines or anything like that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Cooper. So you're there at Cooper with the Sustainable Institute, which is not really part of the architecture school, unfortunately.
No, it's not. I mean, what we try to achieve
But do you
is...
have some funding from Cooper Union, or do you have to go out and find angels to fund your institute?
Well, we basically run on grants, and we get a giant grant, which is based on a research proposal. So I think if we now talk about Cooper Union, they obviously have financial problems, and they
Let's
obviously
talk
have
about
to figure
your
out
institute.
How to...
Well, if you look at our website, you'll see that I spent an hour talking about Cooper Union and Free Cooper Union three episodes ago. So we don't need to go there because there's no new news other than the alumni are this is New York fucking pissed as hell. I mean, and we are very upset. And I spent 4.5 hours Thursday night with other alums brainstorming about what we can bring to the institute, that is to say Cooper, not your Sustainable Institute, and how we would like it to change and how we would like it to stay the same. Jury's still out as to what's possible. Anyway, so you have a big grant from...
Yeah, from...
National Science Foundation, was it?
Yeah, I don't... Is it...
What's the matter?
I don't...
You don't remember?
It's a Greek name.
A Greek name?
Soterio, no. Sokoulas, I don't know. It's a foundation.
A Greek foundation.
Yeah, Kevin Bone set it up, so... he's been around
but basically
forever.
This grant is running out next year, and we're doing research right now, which we're using the money of the grant. But we also have to think in the future, and I mean, grants are never guaranteed. So,
of course,
therefore, you know, the institute definitely has to figure out ways on how to fund themselves, and it's a very difficult process. And I can only talk about Terraform One as well because it's also a non-profit, and one way to fund ourselves is to run grants or win competitions, and
then from that
money you.
Sure.
You slowly try to survive. So it's a very tough, you know, it's a very tough position because you never know for how long you can keep on going.
Right.
Yeah, well, a lot at Terraform One, a lot of us teach, and teaching also helps fund our own, kind of gets our own salaries going and gives us enough time to let the office kind of move about. And I think if you look back at a lot of early, more experimentalist offices, they were bringing in large incomes. And
we're not.
Yeah, we're not. And
yeah,
they were,
of course.
They were, yeah. And because they're not building, you know, brick lumps or, you know, some doing an interior for the Gap or what have you. And I think that we want it to be a little bit more honest about this kind of practice. Previously, those practices have always been for-profit practices. Peter Eisman is still a for-profit practice, and he's done a great job,
Peter,
with what he's done.
You know, I have to drop the first shoe here, Mitch.
Yeah.
Peter Eisman is an architect.
Yeah.
You're not licensed.
No.
What do you?
I have a doctorate in architecture. I think that is a way different kind of practice.
And but it's not a practice.
No. Well, John Haydack
was licensed.
And did not practice architecture.
But you can't accept an architectural license. You can't accept an architectural commission.
Of course I can. So look at Daniel Liebskin. Daniel Liebskin's not licensed, and he could build whatever he feels like. You can
Could you check that? New York State education.
Yeah.
Online verification.
You could team up with an executive architect and build a project.
So you think that you're an architect just because you have a PhD?
No, I think I'm an architect because I practice in the field.
You don't practice.
I practice architecture.
To call yourself an architect in New York State is actually an actionable act of.
Fraud. I'm fully aware.
You're a smart guy. You know the statutes, right?
Yeah.
So what's holding you back from getting a license?
I don't do work that necessarily needs one.
Why don't you just get a license? I've posed this question to Liz Diller.
Yeah.
I warned you.
Are you a...
Am I licensed? Yes.
Okay. So this is what
Ask me how many states.
This is what I think about a license in the state of New York to practice architecture. I think that you belong to the AIA.
I think the AIA is
a pseudo union that does not represent or care for young architects.
You're an associate member of the AIA.
Exactly. I'm an associate member.
Okay, but that doesn't make you an architect because it's illegally. I read a lot of contracts. Does that make me an attorney at law?
It doesn't make you an attorney at law.
I know a lot about medicine. Does that make me a physician?
Nope.
You know a lot about architecture, but you haven't passed the architect's registration exam.
I never took the architect's registration.
Well, when are you going to get licensed?
I have no desire to ever get licensed.
So are you going to stop calling yourself an architect?
I will never stop calling me an architect.
Really?
Yeah.
So you don't mind.
But you know what I do is architecture. You're going to tell me what I do is not architecture? Because you know exactly it's architecture. It's in every history book on architecture. It's the same kind of field of thought that's been around for a long time. If we were in Germany, I could build a skyscraper if I felt like. If I was in Taiwan,
is that true,
I could be. Yeah, of course.
If he doesn't have a European degree.
I think you don't need a European degree to do. You have to work in an office for 2 to 3 years, and then you can start building projects in Germany. And if you're in London,
That's if you have a diploma in architecture from a European school.
Well, maybe that just gets now into this whole question, okay? Because the other day in the newspaper, there was this giant map which showed that 14% of fresh graduate students in architecture are without employment. Yeah. And that was within the United States. And we have the highest unemployment rate.
13.9% are unemployed.
So I think if we talk about licensing and all the stuff, we actually have to talk about The Education of an Architect, which is one famous book which Cooper Union produced. And I think that gets into the whole question of, is it even worth getting an architecture degree and getting
that
yourself...
That is exactly my point. Now, should, and we've discussed this for 3 or 4 hours on this program, in this studio,
yes,
with people who are licensed and not licensed, and you're the first willing to actually defend the position that you think, as I impute from what you said, that architecture should be deregulated.
I would say the license. Architecture as a field should be deregulated?
No, as a practice. You feel that you're a practicing architect. But you have no license.
I don't feel. I'm absolutely positive.
No, you're not.
I am positive I'm a practicing architect.
You are not a practicing architect.
Well, if
what's your architectural license number? You're not licensed to practice architecture, Mitch.
No, that's a license. That's some. That first of all, the license only grants you the legal ability to stamp a drawing. End of story. It doesn't talk about the cultural, theoretical.
Mitch, if you were driving a car.
Yeah.
And you had a burned out taillight. Mm-hmm. And you got pulled over, and they asked you for your driver's license.
Yep.
What would you say? I've been driving all my life.
Exactly.
And then what would happen?
And they'd look at my record, and they'd see that I practice an Indy 500 level racing.
And then what would happen?
They'd give me a $50 fine, if not let me go.
So you understand.
And if I decided to fight it in court, I'd destroy whatever, two-bit lawyer was coming up against me.
You think so?
Don't you think so?
No.
Why?
Because you don't have...
I'm not signing drawings.
You don't have a driver's license.
But I'm not signing drawings.
I think you should look at the statute very clearly.
I see what the statute says, and I disagree with what the statute says.
You can't say that you're
It's like
architect.
Marijuana. You smoke marijuana? I smoke marijuana. It's illegal.
I don't smoke marijuana.
Okay, I like marijuana.
Well, that's fine. I'm not talking about marijuana.
The President of the United States smoked marijuana. It's illegal. Should he be not President of the United States?
No, he never inhaled.
Yeah. He actually did inhale. Obama inhaled. Yeah, I think it's just because some.
So you're on the record saying that you, Mitch.
I am on the record saying that
you.
The
you
only
figure
reason,
that you're an architect.
I don't think I know.
No, you're not.
You can tell me whatever you want.
Well, are you a doctor because you know something about medicine?
I am a doctor. I have a PhD.
Are you a physician because you know something about medicine?
That's not... If I've been practicing medicine in all of my life, and I heal people day to day. In fact, if I advance the field,
so
I'm
a doctor. So, in other words, you are standing. You, Mitchell Joachim, are standing in defiance against the state of New York saying that you are willing to take a stance.
I am absolutely standing in defiance
of
that regulation,
That you are... an architect, and you will state publicly that you are an architect.
I am stating it publicly. I happily will. I totally agree.
And you really don't care that
the statute says
that you're stating that you are an architect
yes.
without a license is a class E? We can look that up. Felony. It's a felony.
It's not a felony. I have no idea whether it's not a felony.
Well,
okay, bring it.
Well, okay, you have a PhD from MIT.
Yeah.
I guess you know how to read. I'm asking you. This is a very hot issue with some people that I know in the profession because they have students who say to them, rightfully so, I'm busting my ass to get licensed.
Yeah.
How is it that Liz Diller or Preston Scott Cohen Or Mitch Joachim.
Or Daniel Liebskin. And I'm not in the same class as those guys, but they're doing great work.
Can hold themselves out as if they are architects. And I'm trying to become an architect, because until you are licensed, you are not an architect. And nobody comes down and reminds them that they're saying that they're architects is actually illegal. And you're saying you don't care if it's illegal. You're just going to do that.
I certainly do care about respect for the laws that are in place, and certainly respect for those who have
gotten
licenses.
But not for the architectural licensing statutes.
I have to think that it has nothing to do with the work that I do. And the work that I do is, without a shadow of a doubt, called architecture.
You can't really call yourself an architect. Because
what do architects do? They do architecture. The work that I do qualifies as architecture.
Well, so you're backing off from calling yourself an architect.
I call myself an architect. I'm not backing off.
Well, Michael Sorkin's not an architect.
Michael Sorkin is a critic. He's a writer.
And you're a theorist.
Who is a theorist?
You are.
I do theory. I wouldn't say I'm a theorist.
Well, so why do you call yourself an architect when you're not? What's wrong with being a designer or a theorist or a futurist?
I would think all those categories are just great.
Okay. Jack, let's play something that's a little bit ameliatory from John Q. Haydick.
The fundamental issue of architecture is that does it affect the spirit or doesn't it? If it doesn't affect the spirit, it's building. If it affects the spirit, it's architecture. And architecture doesn't necessarily mean that it's the final form of a built building. A drawing to me is a completed piece of architecture. A building is a completed piece of architecture. A photograph of a drawing or a photograph of a architecture is a piece of architecture. Each act is individually an act of architecture.
But our beloved Dean, John Haydick, was an architect. So when you get a license, I'll call you an architect.
That's fine.
Okay. No, you have to understand. You can't just go around and introduce yourself at TED things and say, I'm an architect. That's actionable.
Well, if
Liz Diller's not an architect because look, Ray Eames, just because she lived with Charles for 55 years did not make her an architect. So, do me a favor.
Yeah.
Take the exam. Join the club.
All right, if the exam changes so that it recognizes master degrees and a doctoral degree.
Sorry.
And
I have
and
a
7 years
in architecture from GSD.
Okay.
And I've been an architect for 33 years.
Okay.
I've been licensed for 33 years.
Okay. Many things.
No, I mean, really.
I hear you.
But that doesn't mean that I can immediately get reciprocity in Delaware. Or Colorado or California.
My question to you is, did you think I have not paid my dues to call myself an architect? Because, or the only thing you're saying is that all I need to do is move through this one hoop of an exam so that it's okay
I wonder if people like you and Liz and Preston Scott Cohen as to why they don't bother to get licensed.
Well, let me put it this way. I, first of all, have never...
No, why aren't you licensed?
I never want to do that kind of work.
So why call yourself an architect? Invent another word. Call yourself an architecturist or
a
designer.
Word. I am a designer as well.
Craig Hodgetts is not an architect.
Yeah.
He's a really kick-ass designer. He's never called himself an architect.
Do you know Charlie Guathame's story? Did you know that one?
Which story?
When he was taking the license exam.
Oh, I don't care how many times he had to take it. Haydick himself had to take it 7 times.
Yep.
Philip Johnson had to take it 9 times.
Yep.
I took it once.
Yep.
You're so smart, you should only have to take it once. You got a PhD. I only got a master's degree, man. You're so super smart. Why are you holding yourself back?
I never thought of looking at it.
No, it's bullshit to say you're an architect when you... Somehow it's like, I don't need to do it. I don't understand the mindset of people who want to be architects but don't want to pay the dues. Yes, pay the dues. Sit for the exam. Is the exam so freaking heavy and hard? No, I passed it. I was a middling student, man.
All right, well, what do I do with that stamp?
You build buildings.
No way, man.
You don't want to build buildings?
No, I mean, I want to build buildings, but not necessarily now. That's first and foremost.
Well, first you have to.
Wait, okay.
How about you have to get a driver's license before they'll let you on the Indy track?
I think it takes a very long time, and this might be something that you could relate to. I think it takes a very long time to truly find yourself at a place where you understand what architecture is, to perform also acts of architecture, and to be an architect. It's not something that I arrived at overnight. I think, as an example, Daniel Libeskind wasn't until he was in his 50s before he ever built anything, his first building being the one in Berlin. For me, my track is, talk to me in 20 years when I think I finally got enough experience where I want to start building something that makes a contribution to the field. I'm not interested in being on the phone all day and fighting over insurance guys, which is what a license is about, is $1 million, more or less, in insurance, and a 50% chance of getting sued, making some interiors for
I've been in practice for 33 years, and no firm, nor myself in individual practice, has ever been sued.
Most practices are sued.
I think you're wrong.
You could get sued for anything these days.
You're wrong.
I don't have the infrastructure to...
Well, I just think it's actually really sad that we still talk about architectural licensing, because I thought we were
talk about architecture,
and it's just the discussion, I think, is not where it should be anymore.
So I just
want you maybe to wrap it up and try to make the point of what you wanted to say, and then maybe move on to talk about real issues, because I think that licensed architects...
I think it's a real issue when somebody like Mitch is held to a high degree of acclaim, says he's an architect, which means something in the United States, mm-hmm. and he doesn't have the bona fides.
I'm an architect and an urban designer.
No, you're an urban designer.
I'm an architect. Okay.
No, you're not.
There is no license for urban design.
Okay, obviously this is going
on. Am I not an urban designer if there's no license for urban design?
I'd be perfectly happy, because it would make excellent radio, if you just walk out because you don't want to talk about
how you're misrepresenting
your professional credentials.
No, I'm agreeing with you that I do not have any interest in getting a license as of now.
So will you agree that you're going to stop calling yourself an architect?
How could that be if I do projects in architecture?
You don't do projects in architecture. You're an architectural theorist. You have a PhD in architectural philosophy. But someone who's gone to law school doesn't make them a lawyer. Hmm.
Someone who goes to urban design school and practices urban design is not an urban designer unless they
There's
get
not a license for urban design.
Oh, that's an issue, huh?
Well, there are licenses for things that affect life safety, health and welfare.
Mm-hmm.
You know these things because they're subject to continuing education credits,
yep.
which you would know because you've
classes.
avoided becoming licensed. No, I mean,
I did not avoid giving. You get a license when there's a building out there. Give me a building. I'll go take the exam.
It'll take you 2 years.
I'll do it in less.
How's that?
I'll do it as fast as possible, whatever it takes.
Okay, I'll
Hey,
see
listen,
you.
I will shake your hand and promise you. You give me a building, I'll get a stamp so I can stamp the building.
But you can't even accept a commission until you're licensed.
My company.
One thing, your company?
Our company can accept a commission.
No, it can't.
Yeah, it can. I can.
Who's a licensed architect who's going to accept it on behalf of your company?
Why wouldn't they accept it on behalf of my company?
And you can't contract for architectural services unless you are licensed to provide those services.
That's where I want to make my point. Because
Please.
Terraform One actually doesn't have a client, and it will never have a client because it's a non-profit organization, and we just try to save the world and think about big themes and topics. And I think that's the exciting part. I don't want to be an architect.
I think it's very exciting.
Yeah.
No,
so,
I agree.
So I think this whole discussion was... It's just going nowhere, and I don't even understand this whole discussion, because in Europe, actually, when we're out of school, we work 3 years, and then we get our license, and it's not like here in the United States, where you're in school, then you're out of school, you have to work, and then you have to take an exam again. So it's just very different, the whole notion.
How long are you in architecture school in Europe?
I was in school 6 years.
All right. And in Spain, people are in school for 8 years. And in... United Kingdom, I think it's 6 years. But there is also a practicum element of that, where you have to break out from your education,
mm-hmm.
And then the final exam, as I understand it, to get your diploma, is equivalent to our architect's registration exam.
I'm a diploma engineer in architecture.
Okay.
That's all I can say.
Well, that's good. So I found it interesting to be able to... I still don't get it. Why don't you just get it?
I mean, if we want to keep it very simple, the conclusion will be if I had a project that required a license.
But first you have to have a license to get a project.
Well, it's a catch-22, isn't it?
But no, it's not at all. I mean, normally, as a matter of doing the right thing, that is the received notions. Mm-hmm. This gets back to what I was talking about, the blurring of distinctions between disciplines.
Mm-hmm.
Landscape architects are doing architecture.
Yeah.
Architects really kind of suck at doing landscape, but landscape architectures are really good at doing architecture, and increasingly they are, and you can, yeah, please take my card. You can look me up. I'm in the database. You'll see. I've been licensed in New York since 1981, probably before you guys were born. So for me, it's kind of an important thing. Because it took me a lot of effort to actually become licensed. When someone says, I don't need it, I wonder what the story is.
I don't have projects that require one.
Well, you don't want projects that require one.
No, because we do not have clients.
We don't take on clients.
Our clients is the environment, is the city, is the earth, is education, is my daughter.
For the projects that we do, doesn't have a private...
It's a different set of mind.
Yeah, the world has kind of changed a little bit.
Yeah. Then
the world has changed.
Then why don't you just... Call yourself something else, like a visionary.
We are something else.
I'm surprised why it gives you such an anxiety that I call myself an architect when you think that in all rational on all rational levels that I am pursuing everything in the field of architecture that's still beholden to the idea of an architect. And that your anxiety is probably because you got a license. I'm not projecting. I understand and respect the idea of a license. I hope you understand, respect the idea of a doctorate and a nonprofit practice.
I understand a doctorate as being basically a degree in theory, but to my mind, there is no such thing as any accepted one theory or even any accepted theory of architecture. It's not like physics, where there's string theory, there's relativistic mathematics.
Right.
Okay, we don't have that in architecture.
Yeah.
Okay. Dr. Vong in Berlin is trying to create a theory of analysis, hypothesis, and observation, but that is not yet codified. There is no one theory, unless you roll it all the way back to Vitruvius, which isn't really a theory, it's just a maxim. Okay.
That's so,
okay. So, I know this has been very instructional because no one heretofore, and I applaud you for being willing to engage me in this conversation, who is practicing design. You're not designing buildings.
That's right, sir.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Curtis, sorry.
It's okay.
I mean, unless you call a house made of meat a building.
No, that's sort of fun in a kind of like Joseph Beuys kind of sense.
Yeah.
You know, felt and fat and meat. And,
yeah.
Yeah, okay.
It comes from that culture.
No. I understand that. It's just...
I wouldn't even know where to begin with the license for that.
All right. So, I'm willing to class you in a different kind of, visionary mold than Scott Cohen, who designs buildings. Find somebody else to take the heat for the liability.
Yeah.
Or Liz. I appreciate your candor. This is Burning Down the House on Heritage Radio Network, brought to you by White Oak Pastures. This has been fun. Keep the faith. Thank you for listening.
for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.